From the Financial Times in New York, I'm Ben McClanahan, and this is FT News. And I'm joined by my colleague, Alistair Gray, to discuss what's been a pretty mediocre second quarter earnings season from the big US banks. All the analyst notes that have come out since the numbers seem to favor words like solid, stable, resilient. There's really not too much to get excited about, is there, Alistair? Or is there more positive news from some of the retail banks?
Well, let's be clear, we're still very much in an environment of rock-bottom interest rates, persistently low rates, and the big driver of retail bank profits is the margin between what they charge borrowers and the cost of their own funds, and that's still very much under pressure. At Citi, for instance, they came in, I think it was about 2.86%, and that's down not very much, but it's going in the wrong direction. It needs to be going up. And
this is the net interest margin.
The net interest margin, yeah. The banks are doing more lending, so they're adding loans. But mm-hmm. in spite of that, the actual total net interest income in many cases is still falling.
Right. So can they increase loans fast enough to compensate for that?
Well, they're all certainly trying. Wells Fargo, for instance, added $10 billion in the second quarter. They're pushing into credit cards, mortgages, you name it, they're doing it. And actually, the low interest rates do have an important, sometimes kind of not overlooked, but maybe this doesn't get enough attention as it should, that, there is a positive side to low interest rates, which is the relief that they give borrowers. Looking at JP Morgan's mortgage business, I think the charge-off rate was already very, very low, but in the second quarter, it was 0.08%.
So is this an unusual credit cycle then with rates where they are? Because normally after 6 or 7 years of any credit cycle, things begin to turn, delinquencies begin to rise, credit quality worsens, the banks take losses. Are we not nearing that stage now?
Well, there's not much sign though that interest rates are going to rise anytime soon. I mean, they're going to stay on, the Fed's going to keep them on hold when they meet later this month, almost certainly. They might tick them up a bit in the months, years ahead. But I don't think anyone's suggesting that we're going to see a ramp up in rates.
So these credit card portfolios, or perhaps the car loans in particular, where there has been slightly shady behavior, hasn't there, at the bottom end, are they starting to look a little bit ragged around the edges?
There have been signs of stress, particularly, as you say, in the auto portfolios. Although the banks have been careful on a lot of the earnings calls to stress that they're still very much focusing on prime, super prime customers.
Yeah.
So that's retail banking, Ben. What about the institutional side of things? How is that going?
Yeah, well, that wasn't much better, was it? It's been a pretty desperate 6 months, all told. The first quarter was horrible, with fears over China and plunging oil and simultaneous collapses in stocks and bonds. Things improved in February and March, but coming off that pretty horrible base, there was some modest improvement in the second quarter, but not a lot. Year over year, the figures are still not flattering to the big investment banks. And the broader picture, of course, is still one of shrinkage. No matter what the banks do, they've all been cutting assets, of course, but the fundamental drivers on some of their key businesses, like bond trading, equity trading, they're all pressing down returns. There was a nice stat from our friends at the Wall Street Journal, who pointed out that since 2010, all told, in the first half, you've got collapses in revenues, even at JP Morgan of 10%. You've got Bank of America minus 35%, Citi 26%, Goldman Sachs 34%. The only one of the big banks to actually increase revenues over that period is Wells Fargo, which came through the crisis in pretty good shape and was allowed by the regulator to buy things.
A lot of focus in the immediate aftermath of the results and how much better they were than expected.
Yeah, but you've got to look back on the 1st of January this year. Take Goldman Sachs, for example. The second quarter consensus earnings per share estimate from all the analysts, all the smartest guys out there, was $3.99. And I think they came in, if my memory serves, at $3.72 for the second quarter. And of course, that was way ahead of this massively pared down forecast of $3.09. So yeah, it's good news that it beat the really beaten down forecast. But over the longer picture, it's still one of deteriorating profits at the big Wall Street banks.
So Ben, to what extent do you think these results tell us about the underlying shape of these businesses? Are the difficulties simply cyclical, or is there some kind of structural problem here?
Well, this is the existential debate happening in every boardroom of every Wall Street bank. At a place like Morgan Stanley, they're very much in the structural camp. They've been trying to reduce their bond trading unit, which used to account for about 40% of revenues at the peak. It's now much, much less than that. And they've deliberately taken measures over the past few years to pare to pare headcount and to reduce risk-weighted assets in that unit. And they're firmly of the view that this is a structural thing. It's not really coming back. Goldman Sachs, on the other hand, thinks we can just ride through this. It's taken limited measures to cut headcount. This year's cutting of a net 5% was drastic by Goldman standards. I think the fixed income unit had cuts of closer to 10%. But it's always thinking the glass is half full and that we're about to be poised for a rebound and that the banks that have preserved the muscle during this tough period will be poised to benefit.
And what about the impacts of Brexit? It seems a bit confusing, frankly, just what exactly these kind of big macro events or volatility in the financial markets actually means for investment banks. Some people will tell you that, you know, it's kind of stops clients from trading because of the uncertainty. Others will tell you that the volatility is actually quite good. What's going on?
Yeah, I think you're right. The messages are very mixed from the investment banks. In the last quarter, they talked about how the uncertainty in the run-up to the Brexit vote caused clients to put off big decisions about raising capital or doing big deals. But they also pointed out that in the days after the Brexit vote, there was an enormous surge of volatility, of sort of good volatility, bets against the weakness in sterling, for example, which drove up revenues from trading from that particular period. So it's always swings and roundabouts. But if you're challenging investment banks for their lack of ability to see through what Brexit means, I don't think they're the only ones. The European Central Bank today was sort of muddling along, saying it needs more time to assess the impact of Brexit. And of course, we may not see Brexit ever. The earliest case scenario could be at least a couple of years away.
And how's the second half shaping up?
Well, you talked about interest rates before. It's all contingent on that, at least for the big retail-focused banks. If we do get hikes, then, of course, that's great news. Consensus forecasts will come up. Credit quality, that's another vital thing to look at. Is it the case, as the banks say, that the weakness in credit is limited to some of these car loans, to some of these credit cards? Will oil continue to recover? The quarter just gone was notable for the, if not reversal of provisions. It was not building to anything like the same extent as the first quarter. So that was another tailwind for earnings. But just take a step back, of course, all the forces, the structural forces we've just been describing, they'll still apply in the second half. They'll still apply next year.
All right, Ben. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.